This week, Vox 39 Red Button gives up its time slot to 10 Years 10 Songs, 1983 to 1992. And this edition features the much acclaimed and distinctive singer-songwriter, poet and author, Martin Newell.
Now, are you sitting comfortably? Good. Then we'll begin.
A life marked out with music. 10 years at a time, one song per year, a song that reminds you of that year. We are not trying to retrospectively make ourselves seem clever or musically sophisticated by backdating things that we discovered later in life. We're picking tracks that are not necessarily our favourite music by our favourite bands, but that instead provide a kind of a map of our lives, 10 years at a time.
Good day to you, or good evening, or good lunchtime, whatever time of day it is. This is Martin Newell guesting on Box 39 for Bill Lawrence with about my third or fourth 10 years and 10 songs. So I'm going to start off with 1983, because that's where we're going, from 1983 to 1992. This is Joanna by Kool and the Gang. More about that in a while.
Everything's fine.
So where are we? It's 1983, and it's about September 1983, and we find your hero, now just aged 30. He's come back to the sinks of the bistro at 9 North Hill, where he'd been the long-term, part-time, daytime washer-up while running a rock career at night of sorts. But he'd been interrupted in March, because what happened, I'll go back into first person, is a chap appeared one day through a mutual contact and said, this book, or these notes you're writing about home recording, we could make a book out of them, and kind of, you'll never work again, or etc., blah, blah, blah. So I went for it, and very shortly after agreeing with this, and the guy, he looked a little like maybe John Pertwee, white hair, and I'm sure it wasn't my imagination, I'm sure that on one occasion he actually did wear a cape. But I mean, I may have imagined it, but that's the kind of character he was. Anyway, shortly thereafter, a cheque for £1,500 turned up. This was my advance. I had never seen so much money. I generally got paid about £30 a week for my washing up, or whatever it was I did then. Kitchen, portering, lugging wine boxes. And so I had maybe a couple of £100 savings, and I thought, I'm going to get stuck into this book right away. I'm going to get up in the morning and work 9 to 5, my usual frantic new work ethic, which has stood me in good stead. So I quit my job as a kitchen porter, and I began on this book. About 6 weeks into proceedings, I think it was, in days before the internet, where transactions took a long while, the bank and the building society actually wrote to you, and the building society did write to me. I got a second-class letter, which just said to me, dear Mr. Newell, your cheque has bounced for £1,500, which means I'd been living on the couple of £100 I did have that had run out, and the cheque had bounced. I was 5 weeks into writing the book. I'd quit my job. I was also acting as a concierge for a house full of students in Wivenhoe, which was great, but a bit crazy. There's lots of animals, a couple of stepkids, and my home studio in a bit of unused household somewhere, wherever I set it up. And suddenly all the alarm bells went, rawr, rawr, a panic, ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling. I rang up the publisher immediately, said, that cheque you sent me is bounced. This is really kind of endangering my entire existence at the moment. He said, never mind. And he didn't tell me what the problem was, but a car turned up a couple of days later. Someone bounded out, gave me £200 and said, he'll be getting the rest of it to me in bits and pieces. It carried on this summer. I never did quite get all of it. Of the £1,500, I probably got about £800 over the period of till we were getting near the end of the summer. I met a bloke who I knew who was a kitchen porter. I said, how's it going at the restaurant? He said, oh, the replacement kitchen porter, the latest one, has not pleased the gov. She was saying how much she missed you. And I said, really? I said, would she like me back again? Because I'd run out of money again. So I downed my writer's quill. I closed over my porter studio for a bit, and I went back to 4 days a week washing up. And do you know what? It was September, and I was really happy with this. I call this complex back to the draining board. It was with my tail behind my legs, but this time I went bounding back, because I just had a basin full of it in the summer of 83, of just wondering where the next penny was coming from, how I was going to finish this book, how long I was going to be dealing with this posh gear. It wasn't telling me lies, but wasn't giving me the truth. And it's the sort of thing that happens if you are a writer or a musician. At some point, people will start bouncing checks on you, and you will go into panic mode, but you must keep going. And so the soundtrack to this was actually Joanna, which was on the radio the whole time. Kitchen staff, especially kitchen porters, love their kitchen radios. They just got it tuned to some inane pop station the whole time. But Joanna was far from an inane pop song. And I remember a very cheerful girl, I think she was called Sue Bowles, country girl from Cornard, I think she was. I remember her singing this as she came through the kitchen. She was a kitchen assistant. And I just suddenly, the bad times of the summer turned into the good times of the autumn. Sure, we didn't have any money. Sure, we didn't have our book out. Sure, we weren't a writer or anything. We were back to the draining board. This was the soundtrack to it, Joanna, by Cool and the Gang.
Red Button, rubbing the warm thighs of radio, and squeezing the fat belly of chat.
In the early 80s, no one was expecting a guy mainly known for his hooliganism in a great and very original punk band called The Damned. No one was expecting a guitarist from that to come out with a version of Happy Talk from South Pacific, which he did. But by 1984, which is my second year, this record came out and it was absolutely brilliant. It was his third single and it went soaring up the charts, and it was called Glad It's All Over. And it's a kind of anti-war song. It sounds really futuristic. It was produced by Tony Mansfield, who I'd met, and a Captain Sensible, who really wasn't expecting to become a pop star, you know, opening supermarkets and dancing around on Top of the Pops for the third time with the Dolly Mixtures, who were a punk girl trio from Cambridge, who I also knew. Now, just to put a bit of background here, I had briefly worked with Captain Sensible before his solo career, only just before it. He was doing some solo stuff in a rural studio in Suffolk. I got summoned up there by the studio owner, who knew us both, and said, Captain Sensible will be interested in you playing some stylophone. Don't laugh. It was one of my instruments that I liked to play. And it wasn't a Rolf Harris one. It was a great big, you know, two stylus, had a reiteration effect on it, and it sounded like a cheap synth, actually, and a lot of people think it actually, that was my cheap synth. I never had a cheap synth. I couldn't afford a synth. I could afford a 45 quid stylophone. And that's how I met Captain. But even I didn't know, back at the beginning of 1982, that by 1984, the middle of 1984, he would be a cherished national pop star that kind of everybody liked, you know. And he'd come out of a punk band. And this was a really great record, so I'm going to play it because it's 1984 to me. Back in the room, Box 39, Bill Lawrence's Box 39, with Martin Newell guesting, doing 10 years and 10 songs. And we're on the third year of it now, which is 1985. In 1984, there were a number of things that happened, but one of them was my politicisation. I was the kind of chowderhead who just liked pop music, and I would have described myself happily as extreme centre, and I still do now, because sometimes at the end of a load of political disputes, you just find a lot of the good guys are in jail or dead or injured or in wheelchairs, and the same old bad people are still running the joint. And I'm not saying that the tussle wasn't worth it, but it's not worth it when blood is being shed, I don't reckon. There are other ways of doing things. And so I was politicised for about 4 or 5 years, during which time I was engaged with various disputes, especially the one that came right to my doorstep in Wivenhoe, which was the miners' strike. I'm not going to say about that, but people I knew were in court. There was disputes between all sorts of people. I can't say any more. But one other thing came out of it was I wrote a letter to Polly Toynbee, because she'd written something about the miners. So it struck me that she'd never met any, and I had met many. But then I had the editor of the Women's Page, a man called Nigel Wigmore, came back to me and said, would you like to write about the miners' strike's effect on your village? And I did. And there I was expecting to maybe get a little patronising, couple of hundred words. So I wasn't used to writing for papers or anything. I'd written for a few music fanzines, and I was a copious letter writer to music magazines. But I wrote this thing. I said, how many words do you want? They said 1,000. I sent them 2,000. And just thought, well, they're never going to run it anyway, so I might as well just say what I want. They ran the whole lot, except for two expletives, referring to our current Prime Minister, Mrs. Margaret Thatcher, a woman the same age as my mum, is one of the only good things I can say about her. And I got this thing published, at which point people who are academics in the small town where I live, it's an academic small town, were kind of like absolutely gobsmacked. I don't know what they thought of me. I assume they just thought I was this kind of henna-haired, punk rock, glammy old yobbo in my 30s who played in a few unsuccessful pop groups, which would have about summed me up. Suddenly I went, Martin, how did you get that article, as it were, in The Guardian? I even got invited to have a Sunday drinkies with a local and quite a famous Tory, which, because of my partner, who was a Greenham woman, who said, if you go and consort with that man, I will leave you. So it was my marriage or Peregrine Worsthorn. So I just said, right, okay, so I'll just invite him to come and have a drink with me in the Station Hotel, the pub at the time, which is where I knew the most workingest of men went. He declined. I didn't go. Things carried on as normal. The missus stayed. She was a good person. I would say of her now, the first Mrs. Newell, she was a good woman to have on your side in a fight or any kind of dispute or battle. The only problem was, because of the radical and politicised nature of the woman, she very often got us into the dispute in the first place. With that, I'm going to say 1985 was a very quiet year, and I'm going to choose for me, and sometimes when nothing happens, when nobody gets arrested, nobody dies, you know, you don't get a record contract, you don't get a book deal, it just chuckles along, everyone's happy, you know, the cats are all right, the dogs are okay, the tenants aren't arguing among themselves. And at 1985, I remember it was a sunny year, during which time Live Aid happened, and this excerpt, which I'll play you now. We're in 1985. We've just played you a chunk of U2. It's U2 from Live Aid, which was almost 40 years ago to the day I'm recording this. Almost. Blazing hot day. All the big haired pop stars of Britain did their bit and came in and did some bits, and it was a jolly good day. And as I wrote to a critical Joe Haynes of the Daily Mirror, former union leader, I think he became Lord something in the end, as so many of them do, who was complaining about the state of, you know, pop stars, and there was no one in the golden old days of Hollywood, like with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. And I wrote him a personal letter, because as I said earlier, I was used to writing. I wrote to the great Joe Haynes and I said that I didn't recall any instances where the great and good of Hollywood made such a massive international philanthropic effort for underprivileged, starving people. I didn't remember any such philanthropy from the massed ranks of showbiz in that early times as had come now in 1985 in the post-punk era. I didn't expect a letter back from him, but I got one. He was furious. He was really cross. He said, I would not normally reply to someone like you, but I'm going to write because you've annoyed me so much. And I thought, job done, job's job. He had his criticisms of me, of course, but I thought, wow, I've goaded someone, you know, somewhere near the corridors of power into replying to me personally. I thought that was really impressive. But never mind that. A lot of people talk about, weren't Queen great? And yes, Queen were wonderful and all this, so I've always found them a little bit boring. But U2 were kind of really good at that point. I'd liked U2 from when they were just a little upstart band from Ireland, you know, mixture of Welsh, English and Irish. Great fusion of, you know, Saxon and Celtic, an exact blend. They made it a great band, especially the first two albums. I really liked them. But they did this song called Bad, just when they were getting epic, and it lasted 11 minutes, so I'm only playing you about 4 minutes of it. But during the course of this thing, it looked like there was a girl sort of suffocating in the crowd there, and Bono doing a typical and brilliant bit of flash, just, you know, was beckoning to the bouncers on, and then he vaulted over this kind of barrier and got to the second level where all the bouncers and the TV cameras were, and he, you know, exhorted these people to hold this girl up, and then he danced with her, and it was all caught on camera. And people said, well, it was staged. I don't care whether it was staged or not. It was one of the greatest bits of rock theatrics I'd ever seen in front of all those people, and I just thought, bloody hell, that's brilliant. I've never done anything as good as that. So I'm just going to play you the instrumental bit while the Edge and Adam Clayton and Larry Mullen, I think his name was, just gamely carried on playing while this unscheduled bit of theatrics are going on. And it really was exciting. In fact, if you listen carefully, you can hear the kind of roar from the crowd as Bono vaults over this thing. I don't care I doubt if it was rehearsed, but it probably was staged to a certain extent. I don't know, but it's just a great bit of stuff. And this is what reminds me of the sort of rather otherwise uneventful and happy year of 1985. You need years like that. You need years that are happy, where no one dies and you just kind of chugle along and there's nothing ghastly happens. So 1985 gets a kiss and 5 gold stars from me, and so do you too.
Red Button. Filling our big sack of conversation with dripping lumps of lovely chat.
In 1986, I bought my wife an electric iron. In 1986, I'd got a record out, my first vinyl record come out. They'd got me home with the German label. It was a complete surprise. I'd come home from painting a house in Whitby, I think it was, with some friends who'd asked me to come home. They were a working holiday. I don't go on holiday, but I'd go on a working holiday. What are we doing? Are we doing a garden, or are we doing a bit of building, or we were painting a house? And I'm a bonehead with painting. So they put me on the ceilings. I did 8 ceilings, 3 times each. I came back covered in paint with a bit of a hangover because the guy who I was doing it for, you know, took us to a really good boozer every night, and North Yorkshire is a fantastic place. Why does anybody ever go abroad, you know? There's some perfectly lovely places, especially up on the northeast coast there. So, when I came back, there was this record. This would have been 85 still, and it kind of did okay. So in 1986, I was looking for someone to at least look after my songs for me, because I didn't know what would happen. I thought it very unlikely I'd go out touring, just because we had a record that was doing well in Germany. But I thought, well, so I rang up my mate Tony Phillips, who I'd been in a band with, and he was now an engineer. He'd engineered for all sorts of people. I think he'd engineered for Joni Mitchell. She liked him so much, she had him wrapped and taken home, you know, to installed in her home studio, I think, at one point. There's nothing going on. She was, according to Tony, a really nice woman. And she could sense when he was flagging, you know, when the recording was getting tough. So she'd stop and make him an omelette, you know. So anyway, I rang Tony. I said, Tony, have you got anyone I could get, you know, just approach to get my songs guarded so no person nicks them, you know, because that happens if you're not very careful. Or someone gets away with it, uses a bit for a film, then doesn't bother paying you or something. So while we were talking about it, I said, by the way, who are you working with? He said, Captain Sensible. I said, all right, yeah, give him my regards. He probably won't remember me, but we worked together. I did some stylophone for him back in 3 years. He said, oh, yeah, he remembers you. And it so happened that he needed a lyricist, because Captain Sensible, by 1986, had been a pop star, as well as still the guitarist of The Damned, and he was getting a bit washed out with it all. That happens. And he hadn't lost his muse musically, but he just didn't. Lyrics are a separate job. So I was invited down there to basically see how we got on with me as lyricist, because Robin Hitchcock, another indie rock musician, very nice but very unusual sort of musician, had left because his career was going all right. When I got home from it all, sometime halfway through, the Smiths had released an album called The Queen Is Dead. And I just thought, wow, this is pretty good. I mean, I had got the Smiths' first album, and I thought, you know, okay, but The Queen Is Dead was actually packed full of good stuff. And of all of the songs on there, the one that is just the most sort of Northern English, full of yearning and wistfulness and romance and melancholy, is There Is a Light That Never Goes Out. And I think if we can play as much of this, if the producers will let me play as much of this as possible, I'd sacrifice some stuff off the other songs, because it was really good at the end. So this is the Smiths with There Is a Light That Never Goes Out, and it sums up that autumn of 86. Take me out tonight, where there's music and there's people and the young and the light. Driving in your car, I never, never want to go home, because I haven't got one anymore. Take me out tonight, because I want to see people and I want to see light. Driving your car, oh please don't drop me home, because it's not my home, it's their home, and I'm welcome no more. And if a double-decker bus crashes into us, to die by your side is such a heavenly way to die. Tempton truck kills the both of us, to die by your side, well, the pleasure, the privilege is mine. Take me out tonight, take me anywhere, don't care, don't care, don't care. And in the dark and under, I thought, oh God, my chance has come at last. But then a strange fear gripped me and I just couldn't ask. Take me out tonight, oh take me anywhere, don't care, don't care, don't care.
driving in your car. I never, never want to go home, because I haven't got one for the long. Oh, I haven't got one.
Box 39, Bill Lawrence, Martin Newell, 10 years, 10 songs, etc. I'm going to go to XTC now, because XTC and the Smiths, between them, they were, and U2, they were the bands that I probably listened to most during that chunk of the 80s. And by about 87, XTC themselves hadn't been doing that well. They'd been getting more and more XTC-ish. And it was, apart from their diehard fans, they hadn't been doing that well. But they did this sort of alter ego band called the Dukes of Stratosphere, where they got the whole psychedelic thing. They did two albums of parodies of the psychedelic era, and they are brilliant. If you ever come across anything with the name the Dukes of Stratosphere on it, and you like 60s psychedelic music, they've parodied it. They parodied it very ably, so much so that some of the tracks are just great in their own right. They go beyond parody into something that's actually original and good. I'm just going to play you one thing from there, The Vanishing Girl, to represent 1987. So this is Dukes of Stratosphere with The Vanishing Girl.
She's my body.
One of them was Arthur, which I'd borrowed when I was about 15 but forgotten all about. And there is this kind of almost vaudevillian song that Ray Davies sometimes does and is very capable of doing, called She's Bought a Hat Like Princess Marina. And it's just a great song. It's fun. It's British. It's got a bit of rah-rah in it and a bit of music hall. It's just what you want, because there was a lot of 1988 I just spent listening to the Kinks back to back and another band called the Sneetches, who you will hear a bit later. I'd lost confidence in modern music for a while. I was just hearing lots of important young men with, you know, things like Johnny Likes. They've got names like Johnny Likes Handbags and you know, Darren Likes Big Drums. They've got these great big drums and big important voices singing like this. And it was all very dramatic and very meaningless for me. So I went back to listening to the things that I'd musically come from. I spent about a year doing that, thinking, not trying to imitate them, but thinking, what were they looking for? I've got to go and look for that.
She's bought a hat like Princess Marina's to wear at all her social affairs. She wears it when she's cleaning the windows. She wears it when she's scrubbing the stairs. But you will never see her at Ascot. She can't afford the time or the fare. But she's bought a hat like Princess Marina's, so she don't care. He's bought a hat like Antonina's, because it makes him feel like a lord. But he can't afford a robe. He tries to feed his wife and his family and buy them clothes and shoes they can wear. But he's bought a hat like Antonina's, so he don't care. But he can just spare me a dime. My wife is getting but she hasn't any food in the larder, knows anybody else in the street. But to look at her, you'd think she was wealthy, cause she smiles just like a real idiot. But she's worn a hat like Princess Marina, so she loves him. So she loves him. She
Red Button, the warm cheese of chat, under the hot grill of Chinwag.
10 years, 10 songs from me. I'm probably already overrunning on it, but what the hell. I couldn't really play you a Dukes of Stratosphere track without playing you XTC. They did an album called Oranges and Lemons. I think it was about 1989. Yeah, this was Chalk Hills and Children. I happened to be spending a lot of time at Captain Sandsworth's place, sort of very near Brighton, and I spent a lot of time cycling around the Downs, you know, because I'm a country lad and I had the bicycle. So I'd cycle to his place from Hayward's Heath, get off at Hayward's Heath and cycle down to the Downs from there, along Underhill Lane, and then up along the Downs and over the top of the Downs. And I got to really like the South Downs. And while and the soundtrack for that, I think I had some sort of a Walkman kind of thing then, was this track, Chalk Hills and Children. Andy Partridge of XTC, really at his finest. It's so good. I couldn't not play it too, so here it is.
I am floating over strange land. It's a sword sequence, showbiz moon. I am floating over strange land. And it's stranger still, there's no balloon.
With my little 8-track studio, the first one, because it was lent to me by Captain Sensible. He lent me a Tascam Studio 8, which for those kind of people who like that sort of thing, ran on a 1/4-inch tape format, had a really good 3-band semi-parametric EQ. I could make 8-track albums, or demos at least. But while I was doing that, I was often listening to The Sneetches, who are an American band. You won't have heard of them, probably. They were half British, they were Anglo-American, half British. I think the other two guys came from Bristol, and one of them, Mike Levy, and I didn't know them all, but Mike Levy I'm in touch with now. He's a really great songwriter. He's if they'd been around at a certain time, they'd have probably beaten the Cleaners from Venus to the punch. They write really great songs. And of those songs, this is the one that was the kind of the soundtrack for that autumn. It's Looking Like Me, it's called. Because sometimes really great things in the international music industry don't float to the top, and you don't learn about them till later. So in case you didn't know about The Sneetches, look them up, S-N-E-E-T. But this is The Sneetches, and for me, it's my track that represents 1990 on Box 39, Bill Lawrence's Box 39, 10 years, 10 songs, with me, Martin Yule.
Another person is taking his place. is looking like me, little girl. Looking like me, little girl. It's looking like me, little girl. Take a look around. He wants the world to open for you. Walk in a garden more greener than blue, and get lost in a colorful haze, and never notice the circular maze. It's looking like me, little girl. Looking like me, little girl. But will you like me, little girl? Take a look around. The leaves are on the ground. Take a look around. The leaves are on the ground. Think about a million times more. Well, if you even find the right door, it may only lead you back again.
By 1991, I had about a basin full of the music industry. I thought, well, how old was I? And I was still, I was probably about 38, but I thought, well, that's me and the music finished, really, unless I'm just doing it, keeping it as a hobby, which my gran always said I should do. Keep your music as a hobby and get a solid trade behind you. She was actually right. So if there's any young people out there thinking, I will get a job in the music industry and I will be a star, forget it. Become a plumber, become a gardener. You'll buy that house for your mum that she wants in the country long before you will if you ever become a pop star. Just do that. I would have done it. Instead of which I thought, well, if I'm not going to make any money and not having any fun struggling in the music industry, I might as well go to a turf which I'd really like poetry, where I can honestly not make any money, because you don't make any money from poetry. Or so I thought. But then something happened. I've been writing these pop poems, and people kind of liked them, and some got published in a newspaper, and the next thing I knew, I found myself on Radio 4's Loose Ends, doing poetry, being offered literature festivals. I thought, yeah, great, we're still not going to make any money though, are we? And so I really hung on to doing my gardening job and general labouring and things like that, occasionally loading skips, you know, up the plank, barrows or bricks one side, me the other, lots of swearing, that kind of thing. Did a bit of that. And at that time, being a qualified, filthy, quite muscly, labouring man in my late 30s, I used to go in the pub with all the other lads when we finished Filthy, Dirty and drink Stella Artois and tell completely unsound jokes. And while I was doing that, one of the records that was always on the jukebox at the Greyhound in Wivenhoe, in the public bar, or the Star Wars bar, as I believe some of the denizens of slightly classier pubs called it, which the poor landlady was very miffed about. How dare they call it the Star Wars bar? But I could see their point. I mean, with a mixture of bikers and labourers and fishermen and all the rest of the stuff. It was great. There was a point where it was just a golden, you know, hit critical, you know. And one of the records that was on the jukebox all the time, which really got you after some Stella and, you know, and a breath of this or whatever, was na 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 na. You could not get this thing out of your head. A great song. It was by somebody called Crystal Waters. This is Gypsy Woman.
Singing for money, la-da-dee, la-do-da, la-da-dee, la-do-da.
And finally, ladies and gentlemen, Martineau on box 39. And finally, the 10th track, which I've saved. It's actually Phil Lynott, or Phil Lynott, his solo album, which had been much earlier, but I didn't actually hear this version till 92. And the Coors did a pretty faithful version of it as well. But when I heard Phil Lynott's version, that was the one that really got to me. It's called Old Town. It's full of nostalgia. It's about Dublin, I think, you know. Usual thing, guy comes back to the old town. His girl's not there, but he's remembering it. And it's a terrific, terrific song. He was such a good songwriter, Phil Lynott.
The same, honey, when you're not around. I've been spending my time in the old town. I sure miss you, honey, now you're not around. Now you're not around this old town.
Leaves me in a place where big changes are just about to happen to me. Some very good changes are just about to happen to me. But it is 1992 and I do not know this yet. I'm starting to get quite a lot of poetry work. I've pretty much put music right on the back burner. I'm not doing very much at all. But I think that year was the year I did a little gig at the Marquee opening for Johnny Moped, and there were a lot of people in Johnny Moped. That was a bit, Captain Sensible was in it. It came out of Croydon. I believe Chrissy Hynde was in it at one point. I actually met Kirsty MacColl and her then husband Steve Lillywhite at that time at the Marquee, but I also met someone else that would be instrumental in changing my career for me, pushing me back to music again. But that was 1993. This is 1992, so you leave your battered poet, musician, sort of reasonably happy, but still struggling a bit, doing a bit of labouring and occasionally notching up a credit. But that's it. I've enjoyed this one. I don't know how much of it. Our esteemed editor, Adrian, down in the basement there with his at the heart of with the nerve center of his evil empire. But this is Box 39, Bill Lawrence's Box 39 on Colne Radio 106.6 FM with 10 years 10 songs. I have been Martin Newell. I hope to do another one of these at some point. For now, goodbye and moi.
Red Button is a Guppy production for Colne Radio and is committed to a varied, equitable and truly inclusive output that properly reflects the ethnic diversity of our community audience.